Iowa Catholic Radio, KWKY and K233BT Des Moines, and KIHS Adel. It's 9 o'clock.
Don't you worry about a thing. Jesus Christ is still the King.
Welcome to The Uncommon Good with Bo Bonner and Dr. Bud Maher on Iowa Catholic Radio. Every Wednesday, diving deep in the truth of the Catholic Church and restoring all things in Christ. The Uncommon Good, live from the Mercy Live Up Studio.
The Uncommon Good is on the air. I'm Bo Bonner.
I'm Dr. Bud Maher.
We are coming to you live, the Mercy Live Up Studio in stormy Des Moines, Iowa. 1150 AM, 88.5 FM, 94.5 FM, streaming live, iowacatholicradio.com, and anywhere that you have the Iowa Catholic Radio app, from Blessman Ministries and the People Abstract Company. Bud, how is life treating you today?
I'm okay. Are you ever worried about mentioning stormy Des Moines for the podcast folks?
Well,
like, they'll be listening to the podcast, and you say stormy Des Moines, they look outside, and the kids are swimming or something.
Well, I want them to, like, get the sort of full effect and the emotions of what's going on here.
Or by stormy Des Moines, are you talking about, like, the emotional
That's right,
of just the city right now?
Because, you know why? Let's date ourselves a little more with this podcast. The Redbirds, the Cardinals AAA team, is pretty much storming into town and beating the iCubs. Oh, very badly.
We were there Saturday night. That was fun to watch.
Yeah, and they're just teeing off. So, you know what, Des Moines, you choose it. Either it's the weather or it's a AAA baseball team we're referring to. It's up to you.
Well, you know, baseball is a superstitious sport, and I don't want to create any bad luck. But the Cardinals themselves are on quite a roll, so.
Yeah. Hey, everyone around here, what's the order of the Cardinals and the Cubs in the standings? I forget. I think it's the Cardinals in the front.
NL Central update. Deacon Tony's about to cut off our mics.
It's a wonderful. It's been raining in Des Moines. All the yards are growing like crazy. I think if dandelions ever become $5 a bushel, I will be a rich man. So it's a nice time to be alive. Wonderful time to be alive. Wonderful.
Yes.
So we are coming to you always underwritten by Mercy College of Health Sciences. So I think we talked about last week. We had our week off, but we've already started back again. And so Bud and I are in there slugging it out in the classroom, fighting the armies of ignorance with the brilliant light of truth, or something like that.
Yeah, the semester kicked off this week, so all the students are bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and ready to learn. So it's always exciting to start a new semester.
And actually, the bioethics, we started bioethics, so that's sort of our topic that we're going to talk about today. So it's always nice to see what we're doing in classroom reflected on the radio show. Also, as always, underwritten by Cartridge World.
Yeah, Cartridge World has all your printing needs. We know Joe down there. He's a great guy, and I know helpful service all around, but it's perfect for businesses, home offices. College students are busy moms trying to find affordable printing supplies, ink, toner, paper, or printers. Business customers get free delivery.
515-564-7400 on 801 73rd Street in Windsor Heights. If the rain keeps up, you can probably row a canoe over
Take
there.
A canoe.
Yeah, just make sure with all your paper goods to include an umbrella. So, Bud, we have a special guest today on the show, like I sort of hinted at. We have a sort of bioethics concern. So who are we going to talk to today?
Yeah, we're talking to Dr. Janine Ejak, and she's a professor of philosophy at Loras College. She's also the founding director of their bioethics center. I think the conversation today we'll mostly focus on end-of-life care, which is a really important topic because when we talk about being pro-life, a lot of times what immediately jumps to mind is abortion, very crucial topic. But in our own context, there's various initiatives at different levels in our society to push practices that are contrary to the Catholic faith. So we're going to get into that some.
This topic ends up being a lot more wide-ranging than you think. People who have listened to our show all the way through know that we're constantly trying to imagine or reimagine some of the hottest topics in, with political ideas in non, so to speak, partisan ways. We don't want to talk about this as left and right, Democrat versus Republican. We want to talk about how is it the Catholic social teaching in a deeper way can inform what the debate's about. I think this topic very particularly is one that's very has a lot of potential for us to make this make sense to people. I don't think a lot of our listeners maybe, I mean, I don't know where they're at, but I think a lot of them would probably understand, okay, this is what the church teaches, and generally this is why I should believe it. I think sometimes people wonder, why do so many people not believe this? Why do so many people so passionately agree with the other side? And I think if we talk about how we understand death and our understanding of public life and private life and how society is wedded together, that it will begin to make sense why the opposite side thinks what it does. And then we might have a much more profitable way to have a conversation with them and hopefully turn hearts towards what the church teaches. So we're going to be back in a minute talking with Dr. Janine Ejak exactly about those sort of things, director of the Bioethics Center and professor of philosophy at Loras College. Stick around with The Uncommon Good. We'll be back in 1 minute.
Established in Des Moines in 1924, St. Vincent de Paul's assists those living in poverty to become self-sufficient by helping to remove roadblocks on their journey out of poverty.
With two thrift stores, a social services department, and an education center, St. Vincent de Paul served over 10,200 clients last year. All of their services are funded by local donations, grants, and sales from their thrift stores.
SVDPDSM.org, 515-282-8327. This message is brought to you by Homemakers Furniture.
Thank you, Construction Professionals, for your support of Dowling Catholic Sports 365. Construction Professionals is a family-owned business dedicated to our customers. Whether designing, building, or renovating, we are here to better serve you. CPCustomHomes.com. Support for Dowling Catholic Sports is provided by Two Rivers Glass and Door, providing commercial glass and aluminum storefronts. 515-222-4860. Joe@TwoRiversGlass.com.
We are back with The Uncommon Good. Bo Bonner, Dr. Bud Marr. Today, we are talking with Dr. Janine Ejak. Bud, you want to go ahead and introduce her today?
Yes, Dr. Janine Ejak is the professor of philosophy at Loras College. She's the founding director of the Bioethics Center there, which provides services to the community both locally and within the state of Iowa. She's also currently a healthcare ethics consultant and chair of the Medical Moral Commission for the Archdiocese of Dubuque. Dr. Ejak has published widely, including works on ethical dilemmas in allied health and in long-term care. So, Dr. Ejak, thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, Dr. Ejak, the whole debate surrounding end-of-life care, one of the things that we were talking about at the opening of the show is, I'm not going to say everyone in our listening audience knows exactly what the church teaches, but I feel that in a sort of general way, a lot of the people we talk to understand why the church would be broadly against euthanasia or some of these other initiatives. What we wanted to talk about with the show, though, is in a wider sense, why is it that there seems to be such a radical incommensurability, a radical disconnect when the two sides of this issue talk? And is there a way in which our different understandings of the social order or individual versus communal, is there something deeper that makes it so hard to talk about to the other side when it comes to issues of end-of-life care?
Now, are you talking specifically about physician-assisted suicide or just end-of-life issues in general?
Well, I think in general, but if we wanted to start specifically with physician-assisted suicide, maybe that's a good way to get into the broader topic.
Beginning in January 2015, there has been an attempt to legalize physician-assisted suicide in the state of Iowa. So far, those efforts have not yielded any real results legislatively. But on the other hand, these attempts are just not going away.
Dr. Ejak, Bo and I teach bioethics at Mercy College of Health Sciences, and one thing that we've discussed with our students, and a topic that can be difficult to get at sometimes, especially if someone's not coming from a place of faith, is there any purpose or meaning to suffering in our lives? Like, in some ways, we live in a time where we've devised all sorts of technological advances that help us push pain to the margins or even do away with a lot of the pain that in previous eras people had to deal with. And so when we get to end-of-life care, in some conversations in our culture, it's like, well, if there's a pain that's connected to a terminal illness and it can't be ultimately mitigated, then it is seen as a kind of good to do away with the patient.
First of all, I want to mention that the church is strongly committed to palliative care and effective pain management. There is a document called the Ethical and Religious Directives for Catholic Healthcare Services, which provides a summary of Catholic moral teaching to guide practices in our Catholic healthcare facilities. And let me just quote from two directives. It says, Catholic healthcare institutions may never condone or participate in euthanasia or assisted suicide in any way. But then it goes on to say, dying patients who request euthanasia should receive loving care, psychological and spiritual support, and appropriate remedies for pain and other symptoms so that they can live with dignity until the time of natural death. Patients should be kept as free of pain as possible, so that they may die comfortably and with dignity and in the place where they wish to die. So there you have a very, very clear commitment on the part of the Catholic healthcare tradition to provide good palliative care and pain management. Now, most pain can be satisfactorily relieved by medications we have available. However, there may be a residue of pain or other distressing symptoms that can't be managed by these means. In those cases, rather than resorting to assisted suicide, there is something called palliative sedation, which involves administering sedative medication to reduce a patient's level of consciousness, sometimes even to the level of reducing the patient to a state of unconsciousness on an ongoing basis until death naturally occurs. Now, this may not be the most ideal state to live in, but it is seen as preferable to resorting to the practice of assisted suicide. So even in those kinds of cases, there is a method for managing the pain.
So, Dr. Ejek, when you get to teach these classes yourself, and you lay out arguments like you did there so clearly, do you have a sense of what sort of arguments or sort of resistance that you get back from your students? I mean, maybe we're different dealing with we don't have a predominantly Catholic student population. Maybe that's part of it. But I just kind of feel that in the water, a lot of younger people they've absorbed a resistance to hearing some of those points. And so I wonder, what kind of feedback do you get from your students, and how do you try to make this a bit more clear to them or guide them in a different direction?
For example, there's a good bit of emphasis on autonomy in our society, that it's my life and I have the right to direct it and do with it what I want. Again, in that case, one needs to recognize that your own actions can impact other people. For example, in states which have legalized assisted suicide like Oregon, the suicide rate in general among the population has gone up. Because once assisted suicide is considered okay for the terminally ill patient, you are conveying a message that suicide is an appropriate method for dealing with distressful situations in life in general. So that's a respect in which the choice I want to make may have repercussions for other people. Also, there's a concern that allowing assisted suicide is going to deprive people who want to continue to live of needed medical treatments, that insurance companies may not be willing to fund the treatments that they want. And there have been documented cases of this. The insurance company, or say the state of Oregon, will send somebody a letter saying, we won't cover this medical treatment for you, but we will cover the medication for you to commit suicide.
You're listening to The Uncommon Good with Bo Bonner and Dr. Bud Marr. Dr. Ejek, wouldn't you say that that principle of autonomy, so in medical ethics, that developed in a lot of ways as a way to counterbalance or act against undue paternalism? So physicians acting in such a way without proper attention to the concerns of the patient and their families. But in some ways, wouldn't you say, like, autonomy has run amok in the sense that, like you were saying, if if it's moral for a person at the end of life to commit suicide, in some ways we no longer have the resources to say that anyone who can make that autonomous decision at any point in life maybe has that option. And so we've seen, isn't it right, in places like Belgium where physician-assisted suicide has been legalized, the society has sometimes had a difficult time saying, like, why shouldn't a younger person dealing with difficult circumstances have recourse to this sort of thing?
Yes, and it's even expanded to euthanasia. But I would concur with you that autonomy has been overemphasized. In ethics, there is also a system that has come out of the feminist tradition called the ethics of care. And the ethics of care sees the individual as essentially embedded in a network of relationships, and that the individual achieves fulfillment within the context of those relationships. That takes a very, very different stance than the emphasis on pure autonomy.
So when you hear something like filling out an advance directive, and I know Dr. Maher involved in this, I think you are as well, where we try to say there's a way in which the church wants to tell people the good of filling out an advance directive, that can sound very medical and clinical, or even sort of almost legal, right? Like, here's the piece of paper, you know, write it all down. There's a lot of people who don't, they feel uncomfortable doing this. It feels morbid, or there's also a host of reasons why people don't like sitting down and doing this. But I think if you think about advanced directives in embedded in what you're talking about, the ethics of care, that what we're hoping for is a conversation about how is my life and then the end of my life interconnected with a whole host and web of people, and that this could be an occasion to be explicit about that. That if I'm going to sit down and write an advance directive, what I'm saying is these are the people in my life that are so connected to me that at the end of my life, I want them to know not only what in an autonomous way, what they do with me, quote unquote, but how we are all going to come together in that time of great need. Would you say that is what is sometimes lacking when we think about things like advance directives?
Yes, the conversation dimension is very, very important. And there is the fact that advance directives can be very, very helpful to family members in making difficult decisions. In this regard, let me mention a project that has been recently instituted by the Iowa Catholic Conference called Advanced Care Planning Consultants. Last summer, we worked on developing advanced directive forms and background materials to assist Catholics in executing advanced directives in accord with Catholic moral teaching. And these forms and background materials have been approved by all four bishops of Iowa for use throughout the state. And we are using what is now called the best practice model for advanced directives, that it isn't just a one-time event, but rather advanced care planning is a process over a lifetime. So we've distinguished four stages. There's an advanced directive form for people who are basically healthy and may just need to appoint someone as a proxy decision maker in case they're in an accident or something like that. The second stage is for people who have chronic critical medical conditions like COPD or progressively debilitating medical conditions like Parkinson's. Those people would make a different set of choices than you would present to those who are basically healthy. The third stage we've distinguished is for people who have been diagnosed as having a terminal illness. The fourth stage is for those who are imminently dying. Now, if you present an advance directive to a 26-year-old asking them to make decisions about what they would want when they're terminally ill, that kind of issue just isn't on their radar screen. And putting the choices in those terms to them is probably going to turn them off completely to the whole idea of executing an advance directive. Now, as part of this project, too, we have trained individuals throughout the state to sit down with people on a one-to-one basis to walk them through the process of executing an advance directive in line with church teaching. And this service is available free of charge. I believe there are 23 people trained in the Diocese of Des Moines to do this. about 12 in the Sioux City Diocese, 7 in Davenport, 23 in the Dubuque Diocese.
Dr. Ejek, earlier you mentioned hospice care, or palliative care, I mean, and sometimes in these conversations with lay faithful on the ground, it seems to me that there can be a little bit of confusion around some of the language about end-of-life care. So there's palliative care, hospice care, comfort care. We use all sorts of these language, but they're different things, right? And in Catholic healthcare facilities, none of those are going to involve practices that are contrary to the faith because of the directives that you mentioned earlier, right?
Correct. Now, my understanding is that the term palliative care is broader in scope than what we know as hospice care. Hospice delivers palliative care, but it's for people who are near the end of their lives, whereas palliative care can apply to anybody.
This is The Uncommon Good with Bo Bonner and Dr. Bud Maher. We're speaking with Dr. Janine Ejek from Loras College, Professor of Philosophy and Director of the Bioethics Center. I'm Dr. Ejek. When we're trying to convince people that radically disagree with us on these issues, like we've pointed out, autonomy is a big issue. Suffering is a big issue. We react very strongly against suffering in our age. I think this is very telling because we have Tylenol and Advil at the ready. In many ways, we're a very unique group of human beings. For most of human history, being awake is sort of to be in some sort of pain, especially the older you get. It seems to me that we're in a very unique situation where we can live our days out imagining not suffering pain, and that really seems to be only first world people and only relatively lately in history. Is there a way in which being disconnected from our traditions, from history, from a deep understanding, or even from the third world, that skews our ability to speak well about end-of-life issues, not only euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide, but even the whole host of understanding how death plays a central aspect in life?
Well, as everybody ages, there are certain debilitating conditions that just automatically set in. Let me give you an example of the kind of mentality you're talking about that really disturbed me. I went through the training program for respecting choices for advanced directives, which comes out of Gunderson Healthcare in La Crosse, Wisconsin. And I was fine with it until I went to the one-day face-to-face training where they were showing some videos about how to interview people to execute advanced directives. And they showed one man being interviewed who spoke about a friend who, because of his physical condition, could no longer play golf. But what the man was doing was to ride around on a golf cart up to a green, putt out there, ride to the next green, etc. And that was not how he was playing golf. This man said, "I would never want to live like that." Now, that side of situation to me clearly demands a pastoral response to help the person recognize that that kind of diminishment in life does not mean that it's time to forego all life-sustaining treatments, that life is no longer worth living. But again, it's reflective of the kind of mentality that I think you're talking about.
I think that is a brilliant example of that. I mean, it's like you said, do I want to be able to walk a full golf course as long as possible? Yes, but if you're thinking that the day you can't do that is the day that you've signed your death warrant, it's hard to imagine, but you're right. That's sort of, I think, Bud, wouldn't you say in our classes, that's it precisely the sort of feedback we get is, you know, and it's a slippery slope. Where do you stop and say this far and not any further is too much?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, Bo and I had a professor in graduate school who said, for Christians, the language that we use is a kind of moral achievement. To be able to speak truthfully or accurately, that is a moral achievement in and of itself. And you can see this in these discussions around physician-assisted suicide and things where sometimes in the broader culture, the language that's used, like dying with dignity, Why is this kind of death more dignified than the other? And to be quite, I mean, I'm empathetic to her situation, but there's even, I would call, like, secular saints, like Brittany Maynard, who was very public about her decision to end her life or to hasten her own death. And our students know these stories, and they've heard this language. And in some ways, we have to step back and even be more precise in what we're talking about. Like, if we say a person wants a dignified death, to dig down and say, what does that entail or what does that involve?
And I think part of that, too, wouldn't you say, is that when we talk about things like mercy, you know, we just got done with the Year of Mercy. The church dwells on the idea of mercy very much. And then you see in these sort of debates, we take the word mercy and, you know, mangle it, whatever word you want to, however you want to put this. But it seems to be not only a trick of being displaced, but it's a trick of language to say, killing someone who can't walk an entire golf course is an act of mercy, wouldn't you say?
Yes.
Dr. Ejak, thinking about committed Catholics who practice their faith and they are concerned about upholding the truths of the faith in the culture, what can that involve? So you've talked about these initiatives to help help Catholics prepare their advanced directives or to identify a proxy. There's probably advocacy there as well, right?
Yes, I think so. I would also say that there are some clear opportunities at the parish level to support people who are suffering at the end of life and their families. Just in terms of being present with them, visiting with them, in terms of relieving their family temporarily of some caregiving responsibilities so they can get out a bit. And I think that these would be effective means, too, of a support for people going through suffering and the end of life as a way other than resorting to assisted suicide. So I think everybody can do something in this regard.
Well, Dr. Ejak, on that note, I think that that's a beautiful way to wrap up our conversation, that we don't have to think about all of this at the big political level. Sometimes it's just a matter of being a real community and being willing to be there with people and even, like you said, give them a break as they're going through these difficult times. So, Dr. Janine Ejak, Professor of Philosophy and Director of the Bioethics Centers at Loras College, thank you for being on the show. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
We'll be back with The Uncommon Good in a minute. Stick around.
Not by bread alone does man live, but by every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord.
Helping you grow in your relationship with Jesus Christ. Iowa Catholic Radio.
Bud, who doesn't like a good story?
Only heartless people, Bo.
Exactly. What if I told you there was a story, let's say a movie,
okay,
and it had fascinating origin stories, epic battle scenes, and powerful arcs of loss and redemption? Wouldn't you want to see that movie?
Of course. It sounds better than most movies these days.
What if I told you it was all true?
I would definitely watch.
Well, friends, the story is the story of the Holy Scriptures, and here at Iowa Catholic Radio, we want you to reclaim the depth of not only the greatest story, but your story as well.
You can hear Read the Bible in a Year every day at 5 a.m. with Gene Wells and Jim Lyons. Friends, you don't want to miss it.
Thank you, Bose and the Flores, for underwriting my show, Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo, heard right here on Iowa Catholic Radio at 8 a.m. Monday through Friday. Bose makes the moment mean more. 515-244-ROSE or online at Bose.com.
Be sure to tune into my show, John Leonetti in the Morning, to start your day. Thanks to Plaza Dental Group, Catholic-owned, and good friends to Iowa Catholic Radio. Comfortable Dentistry, 515-344-3523, online at dmsmiles.com.
Thanks, Cartridge World, for supporting the Uncommon Good.
Whether you are a business, a home office, a college student, or a busy mom trying to find affordable ink and toner cartridges, Cartridge World has what you need.
515-564-7400 and online, cartridgeworld.com.
Announcing the new Strongman event. All men, young and old, will just love this. A new type of fellowship in physical and spiritual strengths to be challenged. This will be fun. A unique blend of competition and conference. Compelling national and local speakers will focus on improving both aspects of body and soul. Register competitive or non-competitive. Buy a ticket to give to a younger man. Let's reach more men for Christ. Go to iowacatholicradio.com to register and download the flyer.
We're back with The Uncommon Good, Bo Bonner, Dr. Bud Maher, and today we have another Unbrilliant question. Bud?
Well, Bo, when we talk about end-of-life care, a lot of times the word death, of course, is bandied about, but we never stop to say, what is death? We use the word a lot, but
right.
When we talk about death, what do we have in view?
See, this is one of the best sort of simple questions that gets complicated really fast. And again, thinking about our bioethics class, this is one where everybody thinks they know what death is until they have to be really precise about it. So let's go through and talk some about modern ideas about what death means, and then maybe we can go back to what the church philosophically has taught. So the predominant idea for death up until the invention of, the ventilator?
Yeah.
Was basically, it really had to do with the lungs and the heart. So the idea is that if you were no longer able to breathe and that your heart was not beating, you were dead. And it made sense, right? Because, like, we had very little interventions that could resuscitate you. I mean, we broadly had maybe CPR type stuff, but people can't do that in an elongated manner. But with the invention of the ventilator, this in many ways throws out completely that understanding of death, because an artificial ventilation machine can make you continue to breathe and, like, make your heart beat, except for the most severe of conditions, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
So then the next idea would be the understanding of brain death. So people would say that you would be dead if your brain no longer registers certain activities. But I'll throw this one back to you. What's the problems we run into speaking to students when we say brain death? Why does that not work out exactly why we think it would?
Well, and like you're talking about, I'm blanking on the exact date, but I think it's the late 50s. There's this switch from pulmonary respiration definitions of death to brain death. And part of it seems to me to be related to organ transplantation, and some of the technologies that were created made it easier to transplant organs. And if you keep the heart beating and the lungs going for a little while longer, it in a sense keeps the organs fresh. Now, I don't want to say that those who developed that technology, that was their intention, but it did create new ethical dilemmas. What makes me a little nervous in the literature today in bioethics is that now you have writers who are talking about higher brain death. So not simply the death of, or, you know, the loss of functioning of the brain and the brain cortex, but this idea that once consciousness or higher functioning is gone, then you can say the person is dead. And that's where you do get into serious philosophical questions, because that's driven by a certain understanding of the human person and what does it mean to be a person.
Now, one other thing, this classic story I throw out, this from the book called Extreme Medicine, and I should have done a better job of looking at the author's name, but if anybody wants to know, they can go to our Facebook page and leave a question. But he gives the example of a woman who, she basically died because she was skiing, I think, in the Alps, and she, quote-unquote, froze to death. So when she got into the hospital, there was no real activity going on. But because she was frozen, nothing in her body really had started to decompose. So what they did is they actually took all of her blood out and slowly warmed it and put it back into her body. And heart started beating, brain started working. And that woman is a doctor today. So not only did she live, she totally recovered. Now, what's funny about this is brain death, pulmonary death, all of the sort of modern theories don't do a really good job of understanding, like, did she die or not? The ancient theory, if you want to talk about a Thomistic one, or the one that broadly the church held philosophically, is the separation of the soul from the body, which might sound very mystical, but what really the mark was is that you were dead when your body started to corrupt. And the idea was corruption could only happen if the form that held the body in its integrity left. And what that means broadly is whatever the principle is that keeps the body as a body and not as a corpse, whenever that leaves or is depleted or is gone, then you start to corrupt. The reason that you see this in the Bible, right, is the Bible is very adamant that when Jesus raises Lazarus, Lazarus has been dead 4 days and he stinks, which means it's not that he, like, sort of fell asleep and Jesus did a magic trick. No, he was dead and rotting. So funny enough, for the ancients, they almost have a better category, which death is when your body starts to rot. Now, why does your body start to rot? Is because it's no longer an integrated whole, which means the form that held it together, the thing that kept it integral, the soul, is gone. And so why I think it's important to talk about this and keep this in mind is maybe that doesn't help solve medical questions, but it gets back to this idea that we were trying to get at, too, that the body is an integration of multiple parts. And a person is an integration of multiple parts, too. Just like you can't think of death as being like, we know you're dead when one part of your body goes through a certain event. It's a whole process. Death is not just an individual perishing. Everybody probably knows the line, "For whom the bell tolls," probably because of Metallica, but if you were a better person, it was John Donne, but I'm not judging anyone. That poem, it's sort of a poem essay by John Donne. So it goes like, "Do not ask for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee." But the point he's making about that is when anyone dies, we all in a sense die, because he starts out that consideration saying, "No man is an island. No man is an island unto himself." When you die, it's not just you dying.
Yeah.
Society, in a sense, a part of it dies and changes. So when you hear the bell toll, in a sense, it tolls for every single person who hears it.
Well, I don't want to scare our listeners today with the most extreme examples, but Bo, you and I have recently come across an author who shall remain nameless, who said, you know, bodies don't have interest, persons have interest. And he was making this distinction between a body and a person. As Catholics, we've never thought that way. I mean, one of the corporal works of mercy is burying the dead. And our understanding of end of life and this communal aspect that you're talking about, it's really related to our relationship to those who have already died.
Right.
And it's wrapped up in all those practices that the church has always put before the faithful. But in some ways, you know, again, on this show, we've never tried to poo-poo technology. Like, Bo and I are not living in a cave. We have air conditioning at our houses.
Right.
But there's a way in which our technologies and some of our practices have pushed death to the margins, and in so doing, have pushed the dying to the margins.
No, I think that's a great way to put it is because we have so much technological prowess. I mean, we fly in the sky in boxes of metal. We never think about it that way. But that's a miraculous, crazy thing that we all act as normal. Because we can do stuff like that, because we can put you on a ventilator, when we finally come to a case where we can't intervene, I'm not saying that we consciously are too scared to do something about it, but it's almost like something deep within us freaks out. Mm-hmm. And so we want to push that to the side, because the rest of our life tells us we're in control. And I think that something like the document To Be Known and Loved by the bishops of the Iowa Conference points out to us that is not the complete story. Well, folks, you know, it's been rainy, so we talked about death. So I hope we haven't bummed you out too much, but I think these are all very important topics. We thank our guest, Dr. Ejek, who came on today. This has been The Uncommon Good. May Jesus Christ, the King of Peace, reign in our hearts, in our families, in our homes, in our city, in our state, in our country, and in the entire world. This has been The Uncommon Good with Bo Bonner and Dr. Bud Marr. We will see you next week. God bless.
The Uncommon Good with Bo Bonner and Dr. Bud Marr is heard Wednesdays at 9 a.m. and 9 p.m. on Iowa Catholic Radio and on the official Iowa Catholic Radio app.
Hi, I'm Chris Magruder.
And I'm Julie Nelson of Catholic Women Now.
Catholic Women Now with Iowa Catholic Radio is sponsoring the annual Walk with Mary to Elizabeth's House in honor of the Feast of the Visitation on May 31st.
We invite you and your friends to walk 80 miles during the month of May, the distance from Mary's home in Nazareth to Elizabeth's home in Judea.
Invite your friends, neighbors, and co-workers to walk each day and pray the rosary.
Awards will be given for those who complete the 80 miles. Text the word Mary to 515-223-1150 to receive more information.
Join us for the Mary's Meals Run on Saturday, May 13th. Walkers are welcome, too. You'll automatically be feeding one child in desperate need of food for the entire school year. Bishop Emeritus Joseph Sharon will lead the opening prayer and bless the runners and walkers before the 10K, 5K. If you can't make the race, register to be a virtual runner or walker. You'll still feed one child for an entire school year. You'll be included in Bishop Sharon's blessing and receive a special video message from Bishop Sharon. We'll also mail you a Mary's Meals t-shirt. Register today at marysmealsrun.com.
Ladies, did you know there are millions of children that go hungry every day, and the average cost to feed a child for an entire year is only $19.50? Mary's Meals is an organization that is now feeding over 1 million children in Africa.
You're invited to Iowa Catholic Radio Ladies Mosaic Luncheon Thursday, May 11th from noon to 1 at St. Francis of Assisi Catholic Church. featured speaker Ellen Miller.
All seats are free, so RSVP soon. Go to iowacatholicradio.com and click events. That's iowacatholicradio.com.
Thank you, Construction Professionals, for your support of Dowling Catholic Sports 365. Construction Professionals is a family-owned business dedicated to our customers. Whether designing, building, or renovating, we are here to better serve you. cpcustomhomes.com.
Pray the Iowa Catholic Radio Rosary every morning at 5:30 and 9:40 and evenings at 9:40.